You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome to Cult from the UBC. It's Thursday, November 23rd, 2017. I'm your host, Olamide Olanion, a staff writer at the UBC. This show is broadcasted from CITR 11.9 FM, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Musqueam people. Cult hails from the culture section of the UBC, the University of British Columbia student newspaper, and we talk about what's going on in the university's culture scene. This week on the show, I talked to Joshua Azizi about the brutal meme war that erupted a little over a week ago between UBC and SFU. Andrea Garza tells us what makes a good meme, and Mariah Lindeer from UBC Slam talks to us about the club, its origins, and how to become a slam poetry champion. Here's the show. We're about to get into our interview with Joshua Azizi about the meme rivalry between UBC and Simon Fraser University, SFU. Just as a quick content note, there's a brief mention of rape and sexual assault in this interview. All right, here's Josh talking about the great meme wars of 2017. In the studio, we have Joshua Azizi, staff writer at the UBC and meme war correspondent. Welcome to Cult, Josh.
Thank you very much, Ola.
How you doing?
Doing all right. Got, you know, a lot of schoolwork, but that's a given in November.
First of all, could you describe what a meme is for the listeners?
Okay, so the term was originally coined by Richard Dawkins in the 70s. I have no idea what his definition is. I just remember reading it and thinking, what is this, basically?
Richard Dawkins?
Richard Dawkins.
Like the biologist, the like yeah. famous biologist
the atheist? The biologist slash atheist.
So weird.
Who just has a tendency to say really weird things and writes really cranky books.
His beliefs are very weird. Anyways, keep going.
Nowadays, it's just kind of like a funny internet, it's just like a funny internet picture that gets remixed in different forms. So, like, one easy example is where the guy and the girl are walking down the street, and then the guy is checking out another girl, and his girlfriend looks really mad at him, and then so people say that, like, the guy looking at the girl, the guy is the youth, and, you know, he's eyeing socialism. And his girlfriend is capitalism, and she's really mad because the youth are just too into socialism.
Are you very into sassy socialist memes?
Oh, man. Though, actually, to be honest, I unlike that page. It was – the joke gets old after a while.
It gets old after a while.
Yeah. All the jokes you can make about – overthrowing the bourgeoisie and slaughtering them all.
There are only so many jokes you can make about.
There's only so many jokes you can make about slaughtering the bourgeoisie.
Yeah, so you wrote an article about the very current and important news in Vancouver last week, the UBC versus SFU meme wars. Could you kind of give us a synopsis of that article?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, to say the least, very important, of course. You know, one of the most viewed articles of the week. But, all right, to give a quick synopsis of it. There's a Facebook group called UBC Dank Memes that I think maybe the first day of November, I can't really remember for sure. They posted this meme. It's where it's like chicken stock, beef stock, laughing stock. And then for chicken stock, there's a picture of chicken stock, beef stock, beef stock, and then the laughing stock is SFU. So what happened with that is that in response, someone from SFU Confessions made a meme back saying like, it was like suitcase, briefcase, rape case, and then with rape cases at UBC, kind of referring to the human rights complaint that's going against UBC at the moment. Kind of, you know, really basically going for a very weak point of UBC's reputation and admittedly calling the university out on something that they have a terrible history of. And so that kind of sparked basically a massive meme war between all the faculties where there's basically each university is dissing the hell Basically, UBC and SFU are now exchanging memes with one another, just making fun of the other one. So, like, so what UBC did instead was, like, briefcase, suitcase, just in case, where just in case is SFU, because, you know, oh, I only, my 85 average couldn't get me into UBC, time to go to SFU. And then going on a little bit further with that, BCIT tried to get into the fray a little bit there. Basically, BCIT's shtick is that, you know, UBC, SFU, we're not going to get any jobs when we come out of university. We're just going to go into like a trade school or some sort of extra program that maybe would happen at BCIT, because BCIT, you know, it's a technical school. You basically go there to learn how to do a job. And my initial, when I saw that, what I was thinking was, you know, BCIT, you're just a small player. You're not even nationally known. Like, you don't matter. So I wrote in the article, however, nobody cares about BCIT, so their contributions don't really matter. And that made a lot of BCIT people very testy. And now that paragraph kind of gets spammed all over BCIT confessions, and it's really funny. See, UBC, we're Beyonce. We're big. SFU, Kelly Rowland, you know, still mentionable, still worthwhile. She's underrated, I think. And BCIT is the third member of Destiny's Child that no one remembers.
Nick Michelle?
Yeah, Michelle. And then Yuvik can be Solange.
Okay, cool. So how did you stumble upon the piece? How did you first notice that?
Well, like a lot of people my age, I spend way too much time on the internet looking at dumb stuff. And I'm in the UBC class of 2021 group for some reason, even though I'm graduating soon. And that was just all over my feed on Facebook. And then UBC Confessions, that's all over my newsfeed on Facebook too. And so it was just kind of all over. And I'm thinking, you know, this is actually something that's, it's culturally relevant. It's not, you know, it's not impacting the people the way that, you know, changing Senate admission requirements would impact people, but it's bringing joy to people's lives. It's funny. So this is worth talking about, if only for a brief little moment. So I figured it warranted an article, and I said to my editor, you know, I know you said you didn't want the blog to turn like BuzzFeed, but, you know, this is a big deal. This is a big deal.
Yeah, so what were the main dragging points?
The main dragging points?
So what were the main dragging points, the firepower per se, that the schools kind of used against each other particular?
Yeah. Okay, well, UBC's main dragging point against SFU is that basically a really pretentious point. Basically, UBC was saying to SFU, you know, we were the better school. We have, you know, the higher admission standards. We're a more world-renowned university. We rank higher in McLean's and such. Basically, ultimately saying we're better. And the students who go to SFU, they just couldn't get into UBC. Which I don't actually think that was the reason for a lot of students going to SFU.
I don't think that's necessarily true, but like, yeah.
But I mean, maybe for a few people. It's just fun to drag them for the sake of it. I mean, SFU is a good school. SFU kind of drags UBC for more specific things. Like, it doesn't just go by reputation. It drags it for things like UBC's bad history of on-campus sexual assaults. Its pretentiousness, high tuition fees. Oh, they dragged UBC Arts a lot because UBC Arts is just kind of known as, you know, arts just gets... It gets a bad rap, which is kind of unfair because, you know, the people in arts are the people who will change the world, I think.
Yes, yes. I have if you can't see me, I have like a fist just like...
He's got
right
a fist
now.
In
yeah,
the air.
Like, yeah.
He put it down shortly after. What Luke Briad Cooper said, he's the admin of the Meme War Frontier, the UBC Class of 2021 group. He was saying that SFU actually... One, because SFU, they actually tried harder. They didn't just go by reputation. They actually had to dig for their answers. And UBC was just like, hey, we're the better school. And SFU was posting more. They got more into this, and UBC Confessions didn't really have a lot. So that made him conclude that SFU won, which I think is a fair point, but also no. No, dude, no. We won because we won.
So what are your favorite, I guess your most fire memes out of all the firepower that was used? Which was like your particularly exciting meme to see?
I think one of my favorites is the one where they have, I don't remember his name, but the dad from Fairly Odd Parents. There's this great meme where he's like, and this is where I would put my blank, if I had one.
And what was
And then that? So for the meme, it was like, this is where I would put my admission into UBC, if I had one. And then that's an SFU student saying that. And another funny one is where, oh, there's a guy and a girl in bed. It's a cyanide and happiness comic that's edited, and the guy asks, so what do you want me to do? And the girl says, talk to me like you're an idiot. And then the guy says, I like SFU's memes better. And the girl just yells out, that's perfect.
Thank you for coming into the studio. That was amazing.
No problem.
That was Joshua Zizi talking about his article on the Great Meme War of 2017. You can find the article on ubc.ca. Up next, we have an interview with Andrea Garza, a writer for the UBC, about her article titled, What Makes a Good Meme? We'll be right back after these PSAs.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Disorders Shindig is back for the 34th year and is hosted at Hastings Mill Brewing Company, formerly known as Pat's Pub, every Tuesday night.
We've curated a spicy roster of local musicians, and there are 27 bands, 27 winners, but someone has to take home the Shindig Winding crown from last year's champ, Little Sprout.
Come watch bands jam out, have fun, and battle it out for some rad prizes provided by our sponsors.
Sarah Fox Postering,
Nimbus Recording, Cannery Brewery,
Pandora's Box,
Vader Master Studios, Rain City Recorders,
Mint Records,
Music Waste, Live from Thunderbird Radio Hell,
Six Cent Press,
Blue Light Studios, Hastings Mill Brewery,
Print Print.
So come out to Pat's Pub November 28th for Singles Night to see King Buzzard, Mushy Face, and These Guy.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
You might want to clear your calendar for the 25th of November.
Why is that?
Because the UBC Africa Awareness Initiative are hosting the most anticipated dance party of the year. Dioko.
Dioko, what's that?
Dioko is going to be a night full of Afrobeat, dancehall, soca, kwaito, and hip-hop. It's going to be from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. at Kerner's Club at UBC.
But where can I get my tickets?
Check out our website at ubcai.org or Facebook UBC African Awareness Initiative for ticket information.
40 years ago, the Pendergai program helped Chinese Canadians and Asian Canadians discover and create community radio. Join CITR and Discorder in celebrating the very first English language radio program created in Canada about Chinese Canadian community on Friday, November 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Access Gallery in Chinatown. Check out the Facebook event or go to CITR.ca for more information.
We're back. You're listening to Cult at the UBC, a culture show from the campus newspaper at the University of British Columbia. Right now, we'll talk to Andrea Garza about what makes a good meme. Hey, Andrea, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's start from the beginning. So I guess I'm going to try to explain what memes are to the audience, and then you tell me if I'm wrong or not. So memes are like this, I guess, internet sensation. They've been around for a while. They tend to be kind of like images, very little text, but they're used to kind of convey meaning or make things kind of relatable. Just let me know if I'm right or wrong.
Yeah, sure. That sounds about right. I would say usually humorous.
Okay, cool. So what are like the major criteria or requirements to qualify? What makes a meme a meme?
So just going with like typical image memes that you'd see, I'd say there's some sort of image which might be called a reaction image that people use, like a screenshot from a movie where some character is making a funny face or something like that, along with text to explain why that pertains to a situation.
Okay, cool. So I guess you talked to Luke Briad Cooper, admin of the Class of 2021 Meme War Frontier Facebook group. What did he have to say about it? What did you kind of glean from him?
Yeah, so he was talking about how memes are sort of a format more than a specific type of image. There can be different types of format. Like one thing that he was talking about was the joke Facebook meme, which is when people will make joke Facebook events. Like you saw this a lot when
the Goku scream.
Yes, exactly. the like everyone screamed like Goku in front of the Olympic cauldron. Or there were a lot during when there were the hurricanes down in Florida. There was a lot of like punch Hurricane Irma to make her go away, like stuff like that. So that's like one of the formats that a meme can take. And they come in lots of different formats and you can apply them to different situations.
There are different ways that, I guess, memes can be used. You mentioned, like, a few different times. So you already mentioned, like, different formats, right? But, like, you mentioned in the article, like, you know, they can be kind of relatable to, like, student life. Sometimes they use, like, as corporate marketing strategies. Sometimes, I guess, like, as the previous interview of this episode will have, like, mentioned, the UBC-SFU meme war that happened a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, could you just kind of give us some examples of the different ways that they can be used?
Yeah, sure. So, well, just to go over the ones that you mentioned, I guess, like, student life is a big one that we probably see a lot, just sort of, like, people complaining about essays and, like, procrastinating and stuff like that, with sort of different reaction images to go with it. Corporate memes, one thing I can think of is the Denny's Tumblr account, which is a very ridiculous Tumblr account where they just basically post nonsense memes about pancakes and stuff, and I guess it helps them sell breakfast food. I'm not sure.
Okay, is that kind of like how like Netflix uses like the Netflix and chill memes?
Yes, so,
like,
exactly. Okay, yeah, okay, that kind cool. of thing. So like yeah. when there tends to be like memes about companies, I've noticed, and then when the companies notice that, they try to capitalize on that in order to like make them seem relatable to millennials, I guess. Yeah. I'm not sure how well it works because when a company like gets hold of a meme, that's when you know it's like dead and you didn't use it anymore. So
cool. Thanks. So I know in the article Luke also mentioned kind of like various categories of memes ranging from you know, ironic to wholesome. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, well, the categories that he mentioned were like dank memes, which are sort of like edgy memes. Like I'm thinking of ones where like people make like 9/11 jokes, stuff like that. That might be like a dank meme. Or wholesome memes are like just like things about like, oh, it's so nice to pet dogs. Like something that's just like really happy. And like Luke called them feel good memes.
Okay.
Then I guess just like relatable memes, like stuff, something about being a student or just other things that are relatable to everyday life. But these are just like some sort of sample categories, and I'm not even sure if they always apply, but it's just like some sort of framework to look at them.
Cool. So I guess you interviewed also, you interviewed both Luke and Professor Sandrine Hahn.
That's great.
What is her focus on?
She is a visual arts prof, and she studies visual literacy. So one of the things that she looks at is sort of how people see the world. And I asked her some questions about like how the internet has changed how we see the world and stuff like that. When I asked her about memes, she was saying that the most important thing to her in a meme is the interplay of the text and the image, because there's lots of things that are made of images, but they're not necessarily, that doesn't make it a meme, obviously. So that's the important thing, is that the text and the image work really well together for her.
Cool. So so that's, I guess, one of the things that kind of are used to judge for quality, right? So I guess we're going to the territory of what makes a meme good, right? So sure. Could you kind of like extrapolate on that a little bit?
Sure. So, I mean, what I found from the two people I interviewed and other research I was doing for the article is that I think the text and the image do have to work well together, but they can't have exactly the same meaning because then it's just redundant. And just sort of fitting well into any of these categories that we've talked about, like how edgy it is or how relatable it is, and also whether it's current. So if it has to do with some current cultural event, that definitely helps it to become popular. Like one of the things I mentioned in the article is the Trump executive order meme, which is when people would hold up he was holding up the executive order and people would change it to say anime is illegal or whatever. Which that one I thought was actually quite funny. Yeah. But so cultural relevancy. And then something else that just makes a meme popular is if a lot of people are just posting it, it'll just become popular because it's everywhere.
Yeah. But I guess you can have all those. Like you kind of mentioned in the article, you can have all those and I guess it still won't work, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Like, I mean, none of this obviously is not a science. Like, it's really up to, like, the whims of the internet more than anything. And, like, there are people who, like, literally study this kind of stuff, like how information transfers and what makes things popular. And, like, it's obviously a really big issue. But it's just kind of interesting to look at how memes are part of that.
All right. Thank you so much, Andrea.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That was Andrea Garza, a culture writer at the UBC, on what makes a good meme. You can read more at ubc.ca. Up next, we have Mariah Lindeer talk to us about the UBC Slam Poetry Club. But first, some PSAs. Stay tuned and don't go away.
Tune in to African Rhythms every Friday from 7:30 to 9 o'clock with your host, David Love Jones, as he plays a heavyweight selection of classics from the past, present, and future. This includes jazz, soul, hip-hop, Afro-Latin, funk, and eclectic Brazilian rhythms.
Lots of people, they take it like a game.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts in Kitsilano and around UBC at
On the Fringe Hair Design, Rufus Guitar Shop, Stormcrow Ale House, The Bike Kitchen, UBC Bookstore, Australia Boot Company, and so many more.
Email volunteer at citr.ca for more
Interested
info.
In learning the ins and outs about mixing, making tracks, and DJing? Introducing DJ 101.9 FM.
DJ 101.9 FM?
CITR and Discorder's drop-in DJ training program. Learn how to use equipment, make tracks, and mix on Tuesdays at the station. No experience necessary and open to the public? What's stopping you from dropping in and dropping some beats? Email volunteer at citr.ca for more info.
Newspapers and magazines did you regularly read to stay informed and to understand the
I've
world?
I've read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically?
All of them.
Want to know more than Sarah Palin? Join CITR's Current Affairs Coordinator, Alex DeBoer, every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. in room 2514 in the AMS Nest to learn best practices for covering local current affairs topics for radio. The weekly training sessions will cover writing for radio, determining newsworthiness, media ethics, interviewing, writing balanced stories, and more. In Digitization is a program that provides resources and training for First Nations and Aboriginal organizations throughout British Columbia. Come out November 24th from 1 to 4 p.m. in room 2311 in the AMS Nest for a three-hour workshop that will engage participants in a conversation about the unique context of working with Indigenous cultural heritage materials, as well as introduce the tools and equipment necessary to digitize audio cassettes for long-term preservation.
Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
Tired of a world of no when you have so much to give?
CITR and Discorder got you with an outfit for all that.
Volunteer Wednesdays are back in the CITR Lounge.
It's an open house for members like you who are looking to meet cool people and get into the station.
Join up, meet some folks, help some causes, or just hang the freak out.
At the CITR Discord Lounge from 1 to 3 every Wednesday for food and good times.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
Welcome back to Cult, a culture show from the campus newspaper at the University of British Columbia. We're broadcasting to you from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people, Vancouver, BC. Right now, we're going to plug into our conversation with Mariah Lindeer about the UBC Slam Poetry Community. Welcome, Mariah. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. So just to lay some like groundwork and like set up the interview, could you tell me about yourself? Who are you?
So I'm a student at UBC. I'm in my fifth year of what was supposed to be a four-year degree. I am a poet. I do a lot of poetry, spoken words poetry, and I'm the president of UBC Slam Poetry Club.
Mariah, I read like a bunch of UBC profiles on the club, and like I think there's one from 2013 that kind of described the club as like a really thriving, close community. I think Heather Gunn, the PR exec of the club at the time, was like, Slam is not as much of a club as it is a community. It's not a society, it's a home. Like just your experience over the past 2 years, I guess, with the Slam Poetry Club, is your experience similar? How does your experience relate to this?
Yeah, it's definitely still got the same heart to it, but there's been a lot of changes with like the technical stuff with what we're doing. So our first and foremost thing is that we want to be like a community of people who love to write. Like the best thing that I've gotten out of being part of UBC Slam Poetry is meeting people that have things in common with me, and it's really great to go to Slam events that UBC Slam runs and to just be around people that love the same things as you. So yeah, I would say that is really along the same lines as it was back then. I know Heather pretty well and Brittany, the president right after Heather, and they really worked hard to make Slam a community. And what I've kind of done this year is try to keep that going, but also to kind of add a bit more of a professional level to it where we actually have funding, and so we're sending some poets to competitions this year. That's kind of what I've added.
Cool, thanks. So how did you first hear about UBC Slam Poetry? And how did you become one of their more involved members?
So I heard of UBC Slam Poetry when I was in my senior year of high school, which is when I really started doing poetry in my 11th and 12th grade years. And I know that somebody I had met through an event who was in their first year at UBCU was doing UBC Slam Poetry. And so when I became in my first year and my friend was in their second year, I went to an event with them, and that's kind of where I met Heather, who was organizing it, and Heather became one of my friends. And yeah, what you really just have to do is go to the events and you kind of just become enveloped in the community.
Cool, thanks. Could you tell me about the club, just kind of like basic organizational stuff? So like how many people, your 30-second pitch about people on particularly with the UBC Poetry Slam community.
Yeah, so UBC Slam is basically a club where we have a poetry slam, so poetry night, every 2 weeks. And that's kind of what it's built around. So every 2 weeks, we have people come out and read their poetry and win prizes. And I'd say we probably get somewhere from like 20 to 60 people at every one of our events. And I think we probably have, you have to become, you have to sign a little thing when you go to the event that says you're a member. So everyone that comes to our events is a member of our club, actually. So we probably have about 120 members this year.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody comes to every event. We usually get probably 30 or 40 at every event, but yeah, around 30, I'd say, at every event right now.
How many regulars do you usually get?
Ooh, there's quite a few people who I know their faces and names now. I'd say you could definitely count on at least 10 people being at every slam of the year.
Okay, cool. So not many people, I guess, know much about the club's origins, right? Do you have any clues or, like, any history or any interesting highlights you want to, like, mention?
Yeah, I actually know the two people that created UBC Slam. Okay. I know them through the poetry community in Vancouver, which I'm also part of. So I started poetry in high school, and the organizer of high school poetry, his job got taken over by another man, and I've kind of gotten into organizing for high school now. So I've gotten to know the new organizer quite well, and he has actually told me that he started UBC Slam Poetry with one of his friends, who I also know quite well now, named Lucia. So their names are Lucia Mish and Johnny McRae, and we actually have Johnny McRae coming in to do a writing workshop and to do a performance for us to kind of bring back the roots of Slam.
So Benny's Cafe is like kind of like the stronghold of UBC Slam and has been for many years. Why there?
Yeah.
What are like the origins of the club's relationship with the venue?
Benny's is a really good venue for supporting the arts. They do lots of other things in the community, not just with UBC Slam. They have a free comedy night. You can rent Benny's to have an event that you want to have. So they're just really a big pillar in the arts community. And so UBC Slam started pairing with Benny's, I think, 3 years ago when Heather Gunn was organizing, because they used to be organized in, I believe it was Kerner's Pub, which was not good for underage. We want people of all ages to be able to come to the events. And I think it was also an issue of, like, how often they were able to rent it and what we could afford for, like, places on campus.
Yeah.
And so Benny's Bagels being so great for the community, I think that's kind of how it started. We wanted to move away from Kerner's and head to somewhere where everybody could be and that was not too far from campus and that was suitable for the fun.
Cool. Do you know if that affected, like, I guess, community members versus, like, students? How many, like, students are coming to that or... Yeah.
You know what? It's been at Benny's Bagel since I was in my first or second year,
okay.
So probably 3 or 4 years ago. And so I was underage when it was at Kerner's Pub anyway, so I never went before that.
Cool.
So it's been at Benny's for my whole experience.
Okay.
But I know that we receive great feedback about it being in an all-ages venue, and we have some people complain that it's off-campus, but it's only $2.99 stops, so they come out anyway.
Cool. Yeah, so I'm just going to go into kind of like the club's beliefs and kind of like the competition system. So like one of the club's earliest interviews from like 2011, co-president of, I guess, Alberto Christof.
Yeah, I know Alberto.
Alberto Christofanini said the motto of the poetry slam scene is the point is not the point. The point is the poetry. It's discrediting the very competition of it. It's sort of a gimmick, almost for getting people to watch poetry. Does the club kind of still hold those like kind of same values and ideals? If so, how?
Absolutely. Yeah. We always try to remember that we hold up numbers and give points to poetry because it's kind of a fun way to get people involved. But the reason that we're all really there is to listen to what people have to say. And that's why we don't give huge cash prizes like some other slam venues do, because we find that people are less experimental and they're more like, oh, I just want to win the money rather than getting up there and expressing themselves with a poem they want to share, but they're worried might not score well. So, yeah, we're definitely focused on the point is the poetry. The points are not the point.
So, like, in the same article, the club expressed interest in making connections with the literature, academia, and, like, general community. What was the motivation behind that?
You know, I don't know what the person's motivation who gave the interview might have been, but I'll tell you the reasons why I think it's important. I think that slam poetry or spoken word poetry is a great genre, but it's also a smaller genre. There are many venues you can go do it at. There's cafes, there's slams, but for being published, it's a little bit more difficult. So I think it's really important to get spoken word poets or slam poets to kind of bridge with the literary community because it gets people stretching what they think are the limits of what they can do. They think maybe, oh, I can only write for the stage. I couldn't write something longer. I couldn't write something that's good on paper. But that's really not true. It's all about experimenting. And so actually what we started to do, one of the big things that I've been getting for since I've been involved with UBC Slam is making writing workshops where you can come in and work on any sort of writing that you like. So we have those writing workshops every 2 weeks.
Cool. Have the connections, I guess, to like the I know you mentioned the workshops, but are there any other kind of connections to like the academia been established?
I think there's threads between people that are in the creative writing program at UBC or English at UBC, but right now we haven't run any events with them, but there's definitely a community aspect, a united community aspect between it.
Cool. So you mentioned earlier that you started sending the club to, I guess, slam tournaments at festivals and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when did this start happening? When did the club start going to slam poetry tournaments?
Yeah. So there's one tournament that happens every year that we've been going to for 4 years now, because that one is a really small registration fee and it's in Vancouver. So that one we've been doing for a while, and it's called the Canadian Individual Poetry Slam. So poets from all across Canada fly into Vancouver and compete. There's about 40 poets from all over the country. So we've had four representatives. It's once a year. So the first year it was a man named Sebastian Wen. The second year it was me. Last year, 2 years ago, it was Jamie Silverthorne, and last year it was Savannah Pulper. And so this year we'll be sending someone else, and our next event, actually, whoever wins the next event, the next slam, is going to be the person who's going to represent us at that one. And this past year we've also received funding from the Arts and Culture referendum, and so we've also been able to go to two spoken word festivals that have been in Toronto and Peterborough.
Cool, thanks. So could you like just talk a little bit about your showing at the Voice of the Day National Festival? Or actually, first of all, let's kind of talk about who qualifies to go.
Yeah, so there's kind of two events that happen every year to figure out who's going to go. So the first one is our next slam, which is in a week today. And that whoever wins that one is the person who's going to compete at the Canadian Individual Poetry Slam. So that's one person. And then in a few months, we will have another slam, so another event, and we will make what we call our slam poetry team. So there's going to be five people. And so we'll take the top five winners of that slam, and those people are going to be the people that travel to the other national competitions.
Cool, thanks. So how was your showing, like, I guess, this year?
It was amazing. We came third in the country at Voices of Today, which was really satisfying. But I think the most important thing about these festivals is the fact that you get to meet people from all over the country that love the same things as you, and then all of a sudden you have a place to stay when you go to Montreal and you have a place to do a show and someone wants to have you come read for their school, and it's just a really great bonding experience.
Cool. I mean, I imagine there's like a bunch of different festivals. Why these particular events? I know you did the one in Peterborough, the Canadian Festival of Spoken Word, and like this one as well. Mm-hmm. So why do you pick those two, I guess, or those couples out of like all the multitude of them in the country?
Yeah, so there's two big governing agencies in North America. There's Spokane, which is Spoken Word Canada, and there's the National Poetry Slam something, which is mostly governed in the U.S., but it's also extended to Canada, kind of like the NHL. It's in the U.S., but there's some Canadian teams. So it's for a couple of reasons that we chose to do the ones that we did. So we've actually participated in all of the Canadian festivals. So we participate in the Canadian Individual Poetry Slam in Vancouver, Voices of Today, which is a youth festival in Canada, and then the Canadian Festival of Spoken Word, which is for any ages in all of Canada. So we've actually done all of the Canadian ones. So that was a big driving factor for us. We couldn't really couldn't afford to go to all the festivals, and it felt weird choosing to go to a mostly American festival that was further away over one that was in Toronto. And secondly, it's just a large distance to cover sometimes when there's a festival in Florida versus one that's just across. So.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so just for like the last few questions, I want to kind of like move towards like the poetry process. Cool. So I guess at SLAM, you kind of present like an original work every other Wednesday. How does one like create that amount of content every other week, let alone like slam winning poetry? Yeah. How can I become like a poetry slam champion? I don't know.
So I think the most important thing to remember is you don't have to perform every time we have an event. A lot of the time, I just go and watch. So I probably perform every 4 or 5 slams. So you're not actually producing like one thing every 2 weeks. You're producing one thing every like 2 or 3 months that's really, really good. And then you go and read the really good one. Or you can go on stage and read the other stuff. But it's important to remember that not every poem you're going to write is going to be the winning one. So if you go perform all the time and don't win, don't be worried. It takes a couple months to come up with a really good one for most people. I think the main thing that you have to do is just write. Make yourself write. Make yourself write like you make yourself do homework. Think of it as something that you have to do. Even when you don't want to get started, sometimes I write a couple lines and I'm like, why am I doing this? And then it starts to come. So, yeah, you just have to make yourself sit down and do it. And then remember later when you're going over it that it doesn't have to be perfect, and that's why we do editing, because it's not perfect when you first write it. So, yeah, I think just come and listen and get to know what you like, and then every few slams, every month or every 2 months or even every 3 months, get up on stage and do the poem that you've been working on for the past 3 months.
Cool, thank you. So, final question, what are the club's plans for the upcoming year?
So we've already done 2 amazing festivals in August and October this year. So for the rest of the year, we have a couple things planned. We have a big showcase planned for April, and we're also putting together a small book of poetry. So we're going to combine that into like a showcase and release show. And we're also thinking about whether we want to have a UBC Slam prom event, because I know that some faculties and clubs do it, and UBC Slam and writing has never really had that, and we think that could be a fun social event.
Cool. Thanks so much, Mariah. That's the show for the week. Thanks to Mariah Lindier, Joshua Azizi, and Andrea Garza for coming on the show. The music for this episode was Knock Knock by Poddington Beer from the Free Music Archive. If you missed part of the show or just want to check out other episodes, you can find our podcast on citr.ca. Don't miss us too much. We'll be back next week. I am Alamdi Alanyan. Thanks for listening.
Hello, you are listening to John Q, correspondent with Arts Report, CITR's premier arts coverage program. Thank you to hosts Jake and Ashley for having me on today. Right now, I am recording from the beautiful closet booth at CITR 11.9 FM's shiny new Nest Broadcast Studio Center. It is adjacent to an equally beautiful hair salon and a set of beautiful washrooms here located on the UBC Point Grey campus, which is, of course, based in the unceded of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. So first things first, a gracious acknowledgement that I am joining Jake and Ashley in their coverage of the Vancouver International Film Festival, this year being the 36th iteration. I won't get so much into the context because I'm sure Jake and Ashley have provided that beautifully. As a humble newcomer, even for me, it's easy to see that the festival is getting larger and larger every year. That means an incline in people attending, an incline in the profile of the event itself, an incline in the cost of tickets. And I will say that while a $2 membership fee, along with $15 minimum per ticket, may be rather prohibitive for a day out at the movies, that the Vancouver International Film Festival has nonetheless put together a fantastic series of films from around the world. First, I'm going to focus on 2 films, one Canadian, one a joint European production. Again, both of these are films which, if you are so inclined, are still available at VIFF for future screenings. And of course, I have the feeling that they'll be around in other capacities that you can enjoy as well. I'm also going to be talking about one collection of Canadian shorts. Again, available for viewing at another VIFF screening to come. And then I'm going to cap things off with talking about a more popular film, which will likely be making the Van City rounds, if not the wider release rounds, later this year. So the first film I'm going to be riffing on, Mass for Shut-Ins, part of the True North, that is Canadian programming series at VIFF 2017. Just going to read the synopsis real quick. 20-something KJ sleeps on his grandfather Lopper's couch. The computer's on the fritz and there's not much of anything to do. There's a lot of sitting around, eating 5-cent candies and drinking pop. Bored, KJ plays with fire, aimlessly wanders through the night, encounters strangers and gets hassled by September, his agro-delinquent brother. Chained to a life of codependency, he passively navigates his isolated existence, but you can see the desire to escape in his eyes. Mass for Shut-Ins depicts a comatose environment in which the aging residents are dwindling away, and the futures of the young are dimly lit at best. Director Winston Djobe bends the mundane slightly towards the surreal, distilling the directionless state of his characters into poetry and poignantly articulating the essence of their milieu. Set in New Waterford, Cape Breton, where the poverty rate is among the worst in the country, Mass for Shut-Ins is a stark yet compassionate portrait of the underclass. And that is from Adam Cook, the synopsis anyway. So the screening which I saw, which was at the Cinematheque, and it was, I believe, the world premiere of the film, my responses coming out of it were very strong. I think the less than gracious compliment one might be tempted to give Mass for Shut-Ins, this new film from Winston Djobe, is that, oh, it's a Canadian version of Gummo. It's about depicting the white underclass in a very, very poor part of the country, Cape Breton, an area that used to get by on the wealth of its fishing and resource industries, which have since terribly dwindled. But it's never to the degree of depravity that you see in a film like Gummo. Of course, I think that's a very unfair comparison, because Mass for Shut-Ins is trying to do something very different. But I also have to say that coming out of it, I was never compelled to say that, oh, this is an amazing Canadian film, that this is a film that really sets a high standard amongst a certain Canadian niche. Rather, I simply felt compelled to say that this was a great film, a film with a very forward-thinking vision and a depiction of poverty that is, and I hate to say this from my perspective to make it sound exploitative and condescending, that is very lived, very real, that has to do with reflection and being amongst, being submerged into a certain mindset as opposed to objectifying it, viewing it from the outside. I think the film in general is very evocative of a sort of ennui and anxiety that honestly exists for introspective, insular peoples across the entire world as we live in an era of relative economic downturn. And as we live in an era when the communities that sustained us, sustained peoples, hollow out around us. Something that separates Mass for Shut-Ins from, let's say, the work of Gummo or Harmony Korine, is that Mass for Shut-In is very reflective. It's not a loud film. It's not in your face. According to Djobe in the Q&A afterwards, he does prefer films which, when depicting a kind of debauchery, get into the debauchery, participate in the debauchery itself, but it is a very subdued and a very sad debauchery, which Djobe said comes from an exaggerated version of the own ennui and angst he felt growing up in Cape Breton. To that end, the film is beautifully shot. The film is shot with very close angles so that you never really get a chance to see the scene as a whole. You're always getting part of the information, and it feels as if you're getting a very subjective and internalized vision of what someone else is seeing or what someone else is going through, as subdued as it is. There's a lot of tender, loving almost shots of people, actors, who look like people that we see every day, not glamorous by any means, and a very realist depiction, realism crossing into surrealism, depiction of problems that seem trite in modern society. Problems like obesity, or sugar addiction, or loneliness, or computer addiction. Things that would be garish and not so cool to talk about. I'm going to paint one portrait of a sequence that happens in this film, and maybe I'll entice you to go see it, maybe I'll push you away, who knows. So KJ and his grandfather spend their days sleeping in and whiling the time away. During this scene, The grandfather, Lopper, gets out of bed. KJ sleeps on the couch, and the grandfather tells KJ that since he's getting up for the day, he can take his bed. He can slide in if he wishes. KJ, of course, grungily moves over, gets into the bed, and half covers himself with a blanket. As KJ returns to sleep, the camera focuses in on an abstract lump of flesh. Of course, in the shuffle over to the new bed, KJ's penis has fallen out of his pajama boxers, and it rests there idly as KJ falls back into sleep. When you describe the scene out loud, I think what occurs to you is that this is comic. Even if it's darkly comic, it is nonetheless comic. And when I think of it, I think of the sadness and the tragedy of that moment, that there's a very human material experience of drudgery and the way it weighs down on the body and the tenderness and beauty which underscores the whole film, but especially in this part, shows something which would ordinarily, in a filmic context, be cause for, disgust or comedy as something that comes through as a moment of surreal beauty. So I have to say, love the film, great cinematography, very tender sense of beauty and sadness around the lived circumstances of poor communities in Eastern Canada, or at least a segment of those communities, and it's only 65 minutes, so even if you don't like it, it is over very quickly. Before I turn to the next film, quick shout out to There Lived the Colliers. It is a short film which preceded A Mass for Shut-Ins, and it was co-presented with the film as well. Its director, Nelson MacDonald, is a collaborator with Dojoby. To quote the VIFF synopsis, There Lived the Colliers, thousands of wooden duplexes that once housed Nova Scotian miners now sit dilapidated and abandoned, testaments to the resilience of the working class people who inhabited them. You see typically straight shots of complexes, complex after complex, many unfinished, many abandoned for far longer than others. You hear hypnagogic, dreamy, looped music, the kind of field recording-inspired ambient that I think you hear from artists like C. Diab in Vancouver. And you get a real impression of the kind of promise these houses once afforded, the suburban dream, the dream of success and prosperity. But of course, these houses were only a matter of efficiency for the mining operations that required miners to work and live there. Again, a very tender piece, a very heartfelt piece, and a piece with some interesting stylistic choices. There Lived the Colliers, which preceded A Mass for Shut-Ins. So, if you liked what you heard, there is still a chance to see A Mass for Shut-Ins. It's playing again tomorrow, tomorrow in the afternoon, so it's going to be a hard show to get to, but I have a feeling that there'll be a chance to see A Mass for Shut-Ins and There Lived the Colliers in some capacity quite soon. So, Mass for Shut-Ins is going to be playing again tomorrow, Thursday, October 5th at 3:30 p.m., International Village 8. It's going to be playing at the International Village 8 Theater. Final comments for today are going to be about a short series that I saw for VIFF. It's called New Skins and Old Ceremonies. It falls under the alt category. Cherry Cola from Joseph Amenta, Flood from Amanda Strong, The Good Fight from Minty Pardot, Let Your Heart Be Light from DeRay Campbell and Sophie Romvari, Lost Paradise Lost from Yang Giraud, and Sea Monster from Daniel Rock and Cassandra Tomzik. Thug from Daniel Booze as well. I think overall the shorts series can be framed as an exploration of social interstices or alternative resistances. In the movie Thug, we see from Daniel Booze, it's a film about black actors in Toronto, or specifically a black actor in Toronto, trying to make it big, finding that in order to get anywhere in the media system, he has to act the part, be the part, replicate the part of a stereotypical black thug, quote-unquote. Very great depiction with some fantastic acting in it. You've also got really surreal pieces like Sea Monster, where Cassandra Tomzik, who is one of the co-directors, also is the lead actor in it. sort of story about this awkward couple who are shored away in this motel for unexplained reason, and there seems to be an unexplained trauma lying at the heart of their relationship as well. There's also Lost Paradise Lost, with some really cool takes on new technology. You see a drone flying through this monochromatic black and white film, and it's so odd, so uncanny seeing something depicted like that. You see GPS and how people's lives are controlled by GPS at one point in the film. It's really so interesting to see something like that depicted in the really thick, noir-like atmosphere, the rich film that constitutes Lost Paradise Lost from Yang Giraud. And that one opens the short series, too. So it's a very interesting sort of setting-the-mood moment, I think, for people in the audience. Of the films of the series, Lost Paradise Lost definitely sticks out in the short film series. Let Your Heart Be Light, wonderful closer from Daria Campbell and Sophie Rumvari, very minor but still emotionally effective story. The Good Fight, which caused quite a ruckus in the Q&A afterwards, and I think there's a discussion to be had about whether films need to be accurate in terms of their representation, or even dramatic films, whether they need to convey some truth to what they are putting up on the screen. It's a film about a young nun at a convent who is exploring her sexuality. She buys a sex toy from a store before taking her vinyl vows and committing to a lifetime of celibacy. So an interesting piece, I think, filmed here in Vancouver. There was Flood, which is part of the Stay Calm and Decolonize CBC series from Minty Pardot, and it's a multimedia piece. There's stop-motion animation, but there's also this sort of silhouetted animation, which is quite beautiful, along with the spoken word poetry that is the narration for the short. You get a real mix of, again, medias. And in this case, I think it works together very effective. It's a very effective coming together of a film. There's also, finally, Cherry Cola from Joseph Amenta, one of the strongest films in the series, about two drag queens moving through the city on a night of debauchery, insights, and revenge. And there's a beautiful closing monologue about the ways communities become means of voyeuristic experience. I will say that typically short series at VIFF have something that really knock my socks off, and in this case, with the short series New Skins and Old Ceremonies, there was nothing that sticks out to me as especially spectacular, but I think there's just a strong feeling of mood between these Canadian films that's shared, that feed into each other, that overall the experience is one that I would highly recommend. So again, if you would like to see New Skins and Old Ceremonies, that is going to be playing once more at VIFF Sunday, October 8th, 2017. So just one more run-through of all the films I've covered. Mass for Shut-Ins and There Live the Colliers, as a part of the True North series, is going to be playing once more Thursday, October 5th, tomorrow at 3:30 p.m. The shorts series, New Skins and Old Ceremonies, is going to be playing Sunday, October 8th at 3:15 p.m. So good VIFFing, and I'll catch up with you soon. Thanks to Jake and Ashley for having me on today. It is such a privilege to be helping the Arts Report do coverage. And you need to stay tuned because they're going to have some more comments about what is coming in the world of arts of Vancouver coming up right now.
Can a rigorous examination of current events help us think more clearly about the meaning of such foundations in the light of institutions and emotions, virtues and vices? Come out Wednesday, November 29th in McLeod, Room 254, to join Professor Thomas Heilig in discussing a close examination of the foundations of democracy, religion and the current crisis. This event is sponsored by the UBC Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum.
The Canadian Foundation for Cross-Cultural Dialogue proudly introduces its new project, Baldwin and La Fontaine, Towards Responsible Government. With your family, friends, and classmates, learn more about the role played by those important figures in shaping Canadian government as we know it today. Visit baldwinlafontaine.ca to discover clips, documentaries, and a teaching guide. Enter the National Web Contest for a chance to win a trip for two to Toronto or a post-secondary scholarship.
Have you ever used or wanted to use a community lending library, collective workshop, or bike co-op?
Come out to Making Space, Questioning Power and Privilege in Makerspaces on Wednesday, November 29th in the Mount Pleasant Neighborhood House from 5 to 8 p.m. to examine how power and privilege shows up in makerspaces and explore strategies that support more inclusive and equitable initiatives. Go to diversityandmakerspaces.eventbrite.ca to register for this event, and there'll be free food.
Am I wrong?
Man, they were nihilists, man.
Huh?
They kept saying they believed in nothing.
Nihilists. Me.
The Great Escape from Nihilism, Rediscovering Our Passion in Late Modernity by Dr. Gordon E. Karkner involves a journey out of the prison of contemporary nihilism and into a meaningful life trajectory. Rooted in the work of Canadian premier philosopher Charles Taylor, this book is a relevant read for students and faculty. You can find it at the UBC or Regent bookstores.
Who's the f***ing nihilist around here, you bunch of f***ing crybabies?
ABC. University Christian Ministry is hosting a coffee house auction to fundraise for sending a volunteer team to a refugee camp in Greece.